Welcome to the Punk Rock MBA podcast.
What's up, everybody? I am Finn McKenty. This is the Punk Rock MBA podcast. Today's episode is with Tommy Rogers of Between the Buried Me. If you're listening to them, you probably know who they are. One of the bigger names in progressive metal. But although people think of them as a metal band, Tommy's origins are actually in the 90s vegan straight edge hardcore kind of scene, the same place that I came from. So I've always appreciated his kind of outlook on things because we share that common perspective. What we talk about in this episode is how he's been able to make a living for 20 years, 20 plus years, playing, you know, kind of deliberately weird left of center music. They've never tried to make anything accessible, and yet they've been able to make a decent living for themselves. So I'm always excited when I hear about anyone who's able to carve out a niche for themselves like that. We explain exactly how they do it. In this episode, we get into a lot of nitty-gritty details about how they do that. So if you are a fan of the band, or if you want to make your living off any other kind of niche in music or anywhere else, then I think you're going to like this one. Before we get into it, there's a couple ways you can support the show. Number one, you can buy some merch if you're interested in that. Number two, you can support us on Patreon if you really, really like us. And also number three, I guess this isn't directly related to the show, but I wanted to mention my social media coaching program that I've been doing for a while now. It's a fit for two kinds of people. What the program does is helps you build your audience and then turn that into some sort of business opportunity for yourself, whether that is selling a product or a service or anything like that. Number one, if you are a creator of some kind, like YouTuber, podcaster, graphic designer, illustrator, anything like that, it's a fit for you. Number two, if you are the founder or CEO or face of a company of some kind who wants to grow your personal brand as a way of growing your company, basically like the Gary Vaynerchuk kind of model, it is a perfect fit for people like that. I've worked with like an attorney, a financial planner, founder of an executive coaching firm, a product designer. So if that sounds like something you might be interested in, you can find a link to that in the show notes. And as always, I want to thank our producer and editor, Deanna Chapman, who makes it all happen. If you have any questions about how to get your own podcast going or how to grow a podcast that you already have, hit her up at the link in the description as well. And with that, let's get into the show. Mr. Rogers, welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I have to put on my podcast voice.
Hey,
watch out for brake lights in 405. Well, we talked about this a little bit. As far as personal stuff goes, but how is quarantine stuff going on the music side of things for you? Because, you know, obviously not touring is bad news for a lot of folks.
Yeah, it's weird. It takes a lot of adjusting. It's just the first time, you know, I've been touring for over 20 or so years, you know, since I was 18 years old. I'm 39 now. So, you know, this is like the first time in my life I don't have like something on the horizon as far as a tour. I mean, there's tentative things, you know, but as all musicians right now, yeah, who knows? So yeah, it's that aspect of it's very bizarre. Creatively, it's been up and down. You know, when it first started, I was quickly motivated and I think a lot of people wanted to like get a lot done, but as we all kind of dealt with, it's easier said than done. And when you're kind of forced to be creative, it doesn't really work that way. And I don't know. I've definitely noticed that I can't just put on my creative shoes and make it happen if it's not there. So I've had good and bad days just like everyone, but you know, making it work.
Yeah. Well, you seem relative to other people that I know, you seem to be a little bit better at rolling with the punches with stuff like this than other people.
Yeah, I don't have anyone to really compare to. You know, I'm honestly bad about keeping in touch with friends and other band guys, and so I don't know. I don't really know comparatively how I handle it compared to other people, but yeah, I don't know. It's a day-to-day thing. You know, I'm one of those people where I get a lot of work done in like quick bursts. Like I'll have a bad phase where I just can't get anything done, but I'm kind of constantly making to-do lists and I have all these things kind of in my head that I need to get done. And then eventually there'll be some sort of spark or something where I just crush a lot of work all at once. and I get a lot done in a short amount of time. So that's kind of how I've always worked. You know, because a lot of times people, you know, they're like, how do you do a lot of projects and write a lot of albums? And it's like, well, for me, it doesn't really seem like much work because it is like spaced out and a lot of it happens in bursts, you know. So I don't know. I'm always kind of, I guess, trying to have a strategy and kind of figure out where I want to go, you know, with the band and, you know, personally with my solo stuff. So,
well, I forget who said this. I think it's so important to understand kind of what your working style is. There's somebody that came up with this idea of a marathoner versus a sprinter. And I think I'm definitely a marathoner. Like, I do the same stuff every day. Like, I'm very, like, consistent. I think most creative people, though, are sprinters. And if you try to turn one into the other, it doesn't work. It pisses everyone off. And I think it's just important to understand what you are and just lean into that.
Yeah, I agree. And it works for different things. Like, for the business side of things, you know, the daily emails and doing all that, I'm very consistent with that. It's like, I wake up, have my coffee, get what I need to get done. But when strictly speaking on a creative level, it's very, it's gotta be, you know, it's kind of I can't really place when that moment is. It just kind of, it's a spark that happens.
So, like, you know, okay, it's going to happen eventually.
Yeah. 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 And that's one thing I've learned over the years, is that to not get freaked out when you get in those moments of, you know, not being inspired, or, you know, the last 2 or 3 weeks, you know, when I have worked on stuff, it was shit, you know.
And but it happens. I mean,
it's
part of the
process. Happens. And that used to scare me. Like, 10 years ago, I'd have been like, oh my God, everything I've written in the last couple of weeks, I've scrapped, or it's just kind of laughable and I wouldn't even send to anyone or, you know, do anything with. And, you know, but, you know, at this point, I know that that's part of it, and I'm totally okay with that.
Well, the main thing I wanted to talk about with you is kind of what you said earlier, is you've been able to make a living since you were 18 years old playing pretty weird music to a pretty niche audience, which I think is something a lot of people would love to do. So I just kind of wanted to unpack some of the things that were, you know, that have enabled you to do that. And I guess the first thing I would be interested to hear is, like, when you decided that this was going to be your career and when you realized that it was actually kind of maybe going to work.
Well, Paul, our guitarist, we were living, you know, in this shitty apartment in Raleigh, North Carolina, you know, when we wrote the self-titled record. And at that point we were still, we were still holding normal jobs and doing that shit and struggling. We were poor.
But these were just like shitty day jobs that you didn't care about, or were you trying to have careers?
Yeah, we weren't trying to have careers. You know, we knew we wanted to play music. We didn't, you know, I think most bands, especially back then, you know, we were from the hardcore scene. So we never went into it like, oh, we're going to do this as for a living. We're going to make money. You know, bands didn't make money.
Like, unless you were Earth Crisis or VOD, who, as far as I was concerned, were like rock stars, who in reality probably didn't make any money.
I know, it's crazy. Like, I think those two bands in particular, I remember that tour and going to see that tour, and that was like the pinnacle for me. You know, like, these bands are fucking huge. But it was at this shitty club. I mean, it was probably 300 people.
Right, and it seemed huge. It seemed so, like, fancy at the time.
Yeah, and I'm sure tickets were $6 or something. So it's not like they were making, you know, actual money or anything. You know, so, you know, back to us, you know, we were working these shitty jobs, you know, with no idea what the future was going to hold. And then, you know, we finally, when we started touring, we were always one of those bands that were never in debt. You know, we always paid our debts before we took anything in. And we quickly realized that if we were smart with our money and never went outside of our means, that we could actually make some money. You know, we were doing, you know, house show tours and stuff, but we were selling merch. You know, we always had merch. We always, you know, that's something since day one we've always taken, you know, pride in.
And this,
you know,
is like early 2000s then?
Yeah. 2001 is when our first record came out. But yeah, we started kind of pushing it and touring in 2000. So yeah, we always try to, you know, always have new designs at every tour. And, you know, we still do that. And, you know, we quickly started making money. And then eventually we dropped out of college, you know, quit our jobs, and we're like, we're making enough. I mean, our rent was probably $300 a month or something, and you know, that's all we had. I didn't even have a cell phone back then, so I mean, we just went for it. You know, I had that, you know, chat with my parents, and I'm sure Paul did as well. And you know, that was 2001. I think was the last time we had a quote unquote real job. I mean, there was some hiccups along the way where, you know, I know a year I moved back in with my mom, and I was like, oh, I can't survive doing this. But you know, it's worked out somehow, and we're still kind of figuring it out. I think that's what's fun about, you know, the journey we've taken is we're still learning, and we're still like, not that we're struggling, but we're still struggling to figure out what works for us and how we can make this work and how we can support our lifestyles and our families and all this by, like you said, playing to a niche audience and playing weird music. Yeah. You
know? So has there ever been a point in which you reconsidered that? I mean, it almost seems like you play aggressively inaccessible weird music, you know? Have you ever thought like, oh, fuck, should we try to go broader?
Well, I think we naturally, in a way, went a little broader in kind of a typical BT band fashion, which is a little off to the left, you know? And I don't know, I think through the years, we saw so many bands completely ditching their sound and trying to make it, and you know, because something is popular, and it never worked, and it was never something that sat right with us. You know, we were never the kind of band that was like analyzing what worked and what didn't with other bands. We always just kind of like did our thing and it worked.
Do you analyze what works and what didn't for your own band?
Yeah, as far as business decisions, I don't think musically we never really did. You know, I think you always had that, you know, that little fan in the back of your head when writing, like, does this sound too much not like us or something? But, you know, one thing we quickly realized is the more we experimented and the more we tried new things, you know, we were lucky enough to have a fan base that, like, you know, celebrated that and they looked forward to that. And we eventually became a band where people didn't know exactly what was going to happen next. And that was, you know, as an artist, that super motivating because you're not confined by any sound or anything, you know. And once we kind of realized that's the lane we're in, we knew that the sky's the limit, and we just wanted to like stay excited as a band. And I think that's why we've had such a long career, is like we're still excited about writing music, and we still, you know, we still don't know what the next step is when we start writing, you know, and we surprise ourselves. And you know, it all comes down to the fan base that, you know, we're lucky to have. You know, we can do these things. And I think a lot of bands can't do that. And I think because we've always kind of had a core sound, even now, I think we still tap into that. We haven't completely lost, like, what people like about our band.
But I think you have kind of established your brand as being genre agnostic. Like, I think you could put out a minimal techno album and it might not be your most popular one, but I think it would go over just fine.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, and I think with, you know, I have solo stuff and Dan has some projects, and you know, we're very lucky that we can, you know, I utilize my solo stuff to really try literally any and everything, you know. And and the fact that the fans are there and willing to listen is pretty tremendous. I would say the one time that I really felt kind of backlash was my Giles record from way, way back, which honestly is kind of a shit record, but it was a very bizarre thing for me to even do and expect for anyone to like. But as I've talked a lot in previous interviews, it's like I learned so much from that moment, because that was the first time in my career that I experienced extreme backlash from media and from fans in a negative way. You know, up to that point, I was kind of in my bubble where, you know, you're in your 20s, like, oh, everybody likes my shit, you know. And then all of a sudden I released something where everybody was like, this is fucking terrible, you know. But it was such a good thing for me, you know. And I still look back in that moment, like, I'm honestly not proud of that record, but I'm proud of attempting something totally off the wall that didn't work at all. And it made me really strong in the sense of, you know, handling backlash and people's opinions and all that stuff. That wasn't a huge thing back then compared to now, you know, with the internet and all that.
Right. Was any of that like a reality check of like, oh, people aren't necessarily just going to like anything I shit out?
Yeah, because I think at that point, like I was saying, I was kind of in a bubble where I'm sure there was some arrogance involved in there. Like, oh, I can do the craziest shit and people are going to love it, you know, where that wasn't the case at all. You know, and not to mention it wasn't very good. I think if the record was good, maybe there could have been some chance. But I mean, at the end of the day of that era, we were like, you know, kind of like a grindcore death metal hardcore band. And, you know, I released a electro clash kind of techno record that was super tongue in cheek. And yeah, didn't work.
Yeah. Well, again, at least you tried it. There's something to that. Well, speaking of the internet, so the internet, you know, has been around since the beginning of the band, but, you know, back in the early 2000s, it was all these weird message boards and stuff like that. Obviously not what it is now. How has that changed your business as a band? I mean, I think it's so much easier now to reach a niche audience all over the world than it was back in the day.
Well, back in the day, it was just, I mean, I think most bands of our generation were kind of late to the game as far as the internet goes and social media, because it wasn't something we grew up with. We were kind of blind to how important it is. And, you know, we obviously, everyone knows now, but I mean, back then it was word of mouth. It was, I mean, I remember, you know, blogs and a little bit of message board stuff, but I mean, in the very early days, it was all, you know, touring and playing these house shows and connecting with bands. You know, we had a lot of core bands like Red Chord and bands like In Our World that we always toured with, and, you know, kind of latch onto their fans, and you just kind of grind it out and you build your base that way. Where now, you know, you're spreading it out through a digital means, and, you know, that just wasn't the case back then. You know, I remember, you know, we did, you know, the CDR thing and the demo thing and all that, you know, where now you can record a good sounding demo and get it out there tonight if you want. You know, it's a different world.
It's wild to me that people complain about that, about like oversaturation and this and that. It's like, well, dude, which do you want? Like, do you want it to be hard or not? Because if you want to go back to the days where it cost $5,000 to record and put out your demo, like, feel free to hop in the time machine, but I don't want it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like, yeah, there's a lot more now, but yeah, back then you were kind of preaching to your friends. You know, it's like, hey, check out this demo, or, you know, in high school, you give it out to people and, you know, hope that they like it and give it to their friends, you know.
And now people are upset that they only have 10,000 monthly listeners or something. And I remember, like, you know, back in the day, it would be a big deal for a band to sell 700 seven inches. I would consider that a hit.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Back then, 700 would be insane.
And to now turn up your nose at 10,000, you know, I mean,
I think the difference is, like we were talking earlier, like, we were never, you know, bands like us, and we didn't do it because you were trying to get big or make all this money. You know, you did it because you wanted to play music with your buds, you know. And I think there was nothing to compare it to, where mm-hmm. now there's a lot of data that goes along with success, you know, quote unquote success online especially. So these people, you know, they're in some chunk of a genre and they see other bands in that chunk and they see, you know, their numbers and they see their, you know, fans. And so they have something to compare it to, where we didn't have anything to compare it to. We were just, you know, besides those Earth Crisis and VOD shows, you know, that was really all, because we couldn't compare it to, you know, going to a big metal, like a Metallica show, right. You know, you had COC or something like that, but that was still, you know, at Ziggy's and Winston with 500 people, you know, so we didn't really have comparisons. And I think that's what's so weird now, is that constant comparison to, you know, what other bands are doing, what other people are doing. And I think that's what people are probably struggling with the most is, and I think even on our level and, you know, people, you know, even some dudes in the band, you know, it's hard to not compare yourself and be like, this band's doing that, why are we not doing that? Like, as anybody that's been involved in this for a long time, it's not how it always works, you know? Sometimes people know people, like, it's just...
Well, and also, just because someone else is doing it doesn't mean it's a good idea or that they're being successful at it.
Yeah, or that it works for your band. I mean, that was something we learned, especially on Ozfest in 2006, when the traveling, you know, fest thing was so big. We realized instantly that wasn't really a world that works for us at all. You know, and that whole summer was kind of misery for us, but kind of like the Giles thing earlier, it was something we had to learn. And, you know, it motivated us and kind of steered us in a direction like, okay, what are our fans like?
Was the issue there just that the Ozfest type of fan is not into what you're doing?
Not into it. I mean, still to this day, we're not the best outdoor band. You mm-hmm. know, we kind of look weird outside. Like we need some sort of production to look cool.
Playing at 3 p.m. in a parking lot is fucking tough.
It is, man. You have to really just be an insane live band. You know, we've always kind of been a band that focuses on performing really well rather than, you know, putting on a crazy show. And so, you know, there was like 15 minute, you know, set changes. We played three songs, I think, because our songs are long mm-hmm. and nobody connected with it, you know, because it was just a small little glitch in the day for them. So I don't know. It was just the vibe all around for most of the bands was, I don't know, from what we could tell was just like this arrogant, like we're going to fucking make it this, you know, this. And we were just like, we're not, this isn't how we are at all. Like, this isn't what, you know, we've never had that get big quick mindset and we never expected it. There's always been kind of like a slow strategy for us that, you know, that fest really showed that it just wasn't working for us to go that route.
I feel like that was kind of the last era of when metal in particular, and I say metal versus hardcore or punk, that was the last era of when metal had this like much more commercial upside. And I think now that's not really true. I'd say they're all pretty much on equal footing now. But back then there was like a difference between the metal bands that had their kind of nose up in the air and were going to get big and had all this money behind them versus the rest of the bands that were more DIY. Definitely the case in the 90s. I feel like that was kind of the last of it.
Yeah, because I think that was one of the last years maybe of that fest. And then, you know, shortly after, I think a lot of the other fests started folding up a little bit.
And Warped Tour has never had that kind of vibe.
Yeah, yeah. We've never done Warped Tour or anything. I believe we got an offer once, but it was probably at the point where we're like, I don't think.
I mean, Warped Tour has never paid particularly well. That's not why you do it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
An interesting thing on this note is that there's a category of bands, I would say, like, you know, you guys, Converge, Periphery, Dillinger, those sort of bands, if you look at the numbers, are not huge bands. And there's a sort of a perception, like you think of Converge as being a giant band, but they're not. And neither is BT BAM. And yet you guys make a comfortable living, like doing what you want creatively. And I think that is such an underrated kind of strategy that, as you said, people feel like this pressure to go big, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to enjoy yourself more.
Yeah. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to last.
Or that you'll even be more successful.
Yeah, I know. Because I mean, there's lots of, you know, quote unquote, bigger bands that don't really make much money mm-hmm. because A, they signed some shitty deal, or, you know, their management's taking it, or, you know, there's a lot of factors. I mean, it's not just the, you know, the amount of sales and you know, how many people you're bringing to the door. It's also about like where you're putting your money.
How much do you get to keep?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, we kind of learned some hard lessons, you know, doing it through the years, you know, about all that. But, you know, that's a big part of it. And that's how bands that aren't that big, you know, stay afloat and make a living from it, is because they learn how to kind of guide the business where it works for them, you know?
And longevity.
Yeah, exactly. I think all those bands you mentioned have done that very well.
Yeah. If you guys want to keep doing this into your 60s, then I believe you totally can. Whereas there's other bands that may have peaked higher commercially, but they're done after 5 years.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's something we saw at Ozfest too. Like these bands that, you know, are on top of the world, they didn't last. I mean, you know, it's crazy how quickly the rise and fall is a lot of times with the big successes. I don't know. It doesn't ever really work, especially in our world, because, you know, the fan moves on, you know, so you got to kind of build it where the fan wants to see what's happening next and not want to move on, you know.
Well, hey, friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like the Lumineers, Ani DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask? Good
morning. I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon.
Hello, Tom May here, host of Future Friday. I've spent the last 15 years on the road with my band, The Menzingers, where I've met all kinds of wild and fascinating people. So I started a podcast. On Future Friday, I talk to fellow musicians about the moments that made them, their passions outside of music, and the curiosities that tie us all together. I've also talked to the likes of UFO researchers, magicians, soldiers, and documentary filmmakers, and I'm constantly searching for folks that can shape and change our view of the world. You can check out Future Friday wherever you like.
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services, DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, you can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player. And when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode.
Are there any particular pieces of advice that you might have to somebody as far as like, if they want to pursue this kind of a career, deepening a relationship with a niche audience?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think the audience can tell what kind of music you're writing. And when I say that, I mean how genuine it is. I think you can tell the second you're writing music to sound like somebody else, or you're kind of being yourself. And I think that's, for us at least, that's the best way to like have people connect with you. And I think something that's worked for us is we've never pretended to be something we're not. We've always been, you know, just five kind of normal guys that like to write these songs, you know, and that's at the end of the day what we've always been. And I think through that, our fans have latched on to like, I don't know, I guess we're kind of normal people, you know, and they like that aspect of it and they can relate to it. And I don't know, I think obviously first and foremost is you have to write good music, you know, or good to at least your fans' perspective, and not take them for granted. You know, I know there's times throughout my life where I've kind of taken it for granted. And, you know, I think with the quarantine and all that shit is like a perfect time for perspective from from someone's in a band's point of view to kind of look back and be like, shit, maybe we should have cared a little more about the fan and the touring. And, you know, because as anybody that's done it a long time, you have those moments of like, fuck, I'm tired of doing this sometimes, you know? So yeah, I mean, as far as advice, I think it's just be yourself and don't expect anything. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to work hard. You know, that's, you know, as you talk about in a lot of your stuff, it doesn't just happen. You have to fucking, you have to work, you know, and we've always worked, and it still doesn't come. It doesn't just knock on your door. Opportunities don't just knock on your door, and you got to fight for it sometimes.
Well, on that note, one common thread I would say between all the bands I mentioned, and I've worked with a lot of bands in this kind of scene in some capacity or another, and all of them have one thing in common, at least the people I've dealt with, is way higher than average professionalism. And I don't mean like, you know, you show up wearing a fucking tie. I mean, like, our podcast today was supposed to start at 10 a.m. and you were on at 10 a.m. on the dot. And, you know, like Matt from Periphery, if you email him, he's probably going to reply in 3 minutes and if he's awake, you know. And, you know, Kurt from Converge, same thing. Like, these people are all professional. They don't fuck around. They're going to do what they say they're going to do. And that may seem like an obvious thing, but in the world of music, it's definitely not.
Yeah. I mean, it's very true. I mean, and like I was saying earlier about being in debt, and, you know, there were so many bands we would tour with, you know, and you hear they have, we're like 4 tours behind in merch payments. And it's like, how?
That's a big hole to dig out of.
Yeah. I mean, how does that happen? You can't, like, you have to be, like you said, punctual. You have to pay things on time. You know, it's real life. This isn't, you know, it is fun at first when it's not your full-time job, but if you want to make that leap, you have to treat it with professionalism, you know? And, you know, that's something I learned early on, you know, the email thing, correspondence, you know, replying quickly and, you know, and being honest. And, you know, even if you have to say no to things, know how to do that properly and not be afraid to say no, but do it in a way where you're not a dick. And, you know, you just learn all these things. But yeah, it's all that stuff's so important.
Especially when it relies on trust. And I mean, that's really what it is at the end of the day, is your audience trusts you to put out shit that they'll enjoy and to, you know, have a good experience when you go on tour and stuff. And every time you fuck up, you're burning a little bit of that trust. And that's the same in the industry side of things too. You know, there's plenty of people and artists I can think of that I appreciate very much as a fan, and I may like them as a person, but I won't work with them because it's like, well, we all love this guy, but we know that we're going to have to follow up with him 8 times to get him to do the smallest thing. And it's just, I just can't run a business that way.
Yeah. I don't know, just being a guy in a band and a huge fan of musicians, sometimes it's scary, you know, if you get a tour with somebody that you've grown up, you know, loving or something, there's always that moment of like, God, what if they're just an asshole? What if, you know, what, all these things, what if they're not professional at all? Like, because we've all dealt with that. So I think you just always got to keep the fan perspective in the back of your mind. I mean, I remember meeting, I'm not going to say any names, but I remember meeting like an idol of mine when I was probably 15, you know, at a show, and he was a dick to me. And I still remember that. I'm 39 now, you know? So it's like, and that will ever be ingrained in my head. So I think you always kind of have to think about that kind of stuff.
I think about that every time I reply to a comment or DM. And there's some times where I've probably gotten wrong and been an asshole to somebody. So if you're listening and I was rude to you, I apologize. It's something I'm always, you know, trying to get better at. You know, if someone is obviously trying to be a dick to me, then I guess I don't feel too bad about
it. That's different. It's not like, you know, when I met this person, it's not like the 15-year-old fan in me was being a dick to them.
Probably a little bit annoying.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's
I'm
okay.
Sure.
You're 15.
But it wasn't like I said, hey, you guys sounded like shit tonight. I wish you would have played this instead of that.
So you weren't like a European then?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you were good, but new album is shit compared to...
Yeah, well, it's the European personality disorder is real. But, you know...
I love it. I've grown to love it.
I mean, what other choice do you have, you know?
I know. It used to offend me, but now I embrace it.
They don't mean it. And to that point, like, you know, I get messages or comments like that sometimes, and sometimes I'll halfway type out some shitty reply to them, and I'm like, you know what? That's just dumb. Like, I know this person didn't mean to be rude to me. What they said was kind of rude or dumb, but I know that they didn't mean it that way. And this could really, you know, this could really bum them out, or it can make them really happy. So if I ever catch myself kind of going in that direction, I stop, I start over and reply with something nice instead. And I have 100% of the time, I'm glad that I did that.
It's a tough thing to navigate, I guess, because there, I don't know, maybe we've all done it. And I think there is a time and place to be a total dick. I mean,
but it's rare.
I don't know, but it's rare. Yeah. Yeah. So it's just, I don't know, just like anything.
I mean, if someone's being verbally abusive to you, then tell them to fuck off. But other than that, probably not a good idea. And even then, it's still oftentimes a bad idea. Like in public, you know, you think about all these various different like freakouts that people have had, you know, or like one of my favorite examples, and he was right. He was justified to do it. Do you remember when Andy Biersack went off on that guy at Golden Gods?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I love that. It's one of my favorite things of all time. The guy totally deserved it. But at the end of the day, Andy ended up looking worse than that guy did.
Yeah. That guy, they're like, they don't know his name or, yeah.
Right. Andy was the one who lost his temper up on stage. Again, I completely agree with him. It was totally justified, but at the end of the day, it didn't help him.
Yeah, I mean, I think when in doubt, just don't even say or do anything, I guess. That's probably the best advice regarding that.
And that is not easy for me because I have a little bit of a temper when people say things. I don't get mad when people are rude to me. I get mad when I feel like someone asked a stupid question or said something dumb to me that reflected that they didn't pay attention to what I said. That's what makes me mad, which is such a dumb, like, dickhead thing to, like, it's just such a, I'm embarrassed to even say it, but it's the truth.
Hey, I mean, I think, hey, that's important to know those weaknesses and to know that you do struggle with that. You know, I think it's taken me years to not be able to comment or to even look through comments. And, you know, I've tried to get better at that. And I think as a band, we do pretty good with that. Just not bringing it to light, because I think most of the time when you do get aggressive back, it just, like with that other guy you said at the Golden Gods, it just brings attention to you, not them.
Yep.
You know, and that's good for nobody.
Well, how about getting along with people in the band or other bands? This is the thing that, you know, doesn't get talked about a lot, but I think a lot of us, you know, we didn't get into this kind of music because we're like normal, chill, happy people for the most part. Like most of us have at least some sort of an issue with communication and getting along with people and stuff, maybe some more than others. But you guys have been a band for 20 years now or whatever, maybe a little bit more. How do you get along with a group of people for that long?
As far as the band?
Yeah.
Man, I don't know. I mean, part of it is luck. I mean, we really lucked out with the lineup. You know, in the early days, we had a few years where, you know, Paul and I are the only original guys, and we went through quite a few members for a little bit before Alaska. Alaska's when, you know, we have the lineup we have now. And, you know, we just really lucked out with the guys we have, because it's not like we knew them. I mean, we knew them through shows and through other bands and stuff, but you know, when you join a band and you're in a band together and you're touring in vans and all that, you're on top of each other. It's a very, very close quarters, you know? So,
and you really don't know what someone's going to be like
exactly
until you're in that situation with them.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically like getting in four different relationships at once and just hoping it works out, you know, and living together, but, which is crazy to think about, but yeah, I mean, from the get-go, I think, you know, we just clicked as a group. And then, you know, as we got older, we learned. I think space is always very important. We've never been the kind of band where the second we get off tour, we're hanging out or living together. You know, Paul and I lived together a lot back in the day. But, I mean, I think it's healthy to just have that space and to know, you know, over the years, you kind of learn, like when people are in certain moods or, you know, when people need space and, you know, just we've remained friends. I think a lot of bands aren't friends. Mm-hmm. You know, we've met and toured with lots of bands that don't get along, that can't stand to be around each other, you know, but we generally get along. And, you know, like, for instance, right now we haven't been around each other in forever and we miss each other. You know, I think it's healthy to, you know, feel that way and to, you know, be in relationships like that. And, you know, we just lucked out to have that work out. And not only on the touring side, we have healthy relationships. On the writing side, we have healthy relationships. And that is just as important or more.
Tell me what that means.
We work together as a team. You know, we all write creatively. I can write. If I think it works for the band, I'm not afraid to present it. You know, it can be something that at first listen wouldn't make a bit of sense for Between the Bear to me, but I'm not afraid to present that idea. And we're all in that boat. You know, we're not the kind of group that shoots each other down. Nobody is a dictator when it comes to writing. You know, we all have a purpose, which is to create a good album and good songs, you know, and a lot of bands aren't like that. A lot of bands, it is one or two people that's running the show. And, you know, guys can't, you know, they can't.
Or someone
they
gets
want,
mad
they,
because my part in this song is really boring. I don't do anything in this whole song.
Yeah. Or I want to write, but they won't let me. You know, I've heard that before, which is for us is crazy because, you know, we've always embraced. I think that's why our music is so diverse, is because we do have five different personalities and brains working together. And we've learned over the years that it's not a big deal if, you know, let's say I write a section that's near and dear to me that feels great. But when it's, you know, the song's done, that section is not feeling right. It doesn't work. It's not working for the song. It gets cut. You know, that stuff happens and you can't take it personally. You know, just sometimes, you know, that's how music works.
This is a really specific question, but I'm asking because one thing I've noticed in the studio a lot, like with producers in particular, they can be really brutal with how they say things. Like, you know, that sucked. This part of the song is shit, you know, just really harsh. And
which is not the way to go about it.
It's not. And every time they do that, I'm just like, oh my God, I can't believe that, like, you thought that was the right way to give somebody feedback. Can you talk about how, if someone else in the band wrote a part that you didn't think was right, like how would you deliver that feedback?
You could either just straight out say, I don't think this section, you know, I wouldn't say like their name, like, oh, this section so-and-so wrote, like, but maybe like, you know, if you have a 6-minute track, like, oh, at the 115 to 135 mark, I don't think that section's working, or it doesn't flow well into the next part, or I think that maybe that's where the track loses steam, or, you know, something like that.
So don't make it personal, for one.
Yeah, don't make it personal, because it's not about what that person wrote. It's about, does it work for the song? Because I think anybody that writes a lot of music, there's something kind of internally that when you listen back, even let's say solo stuff, because it's all me. It's like when I listen back, you instantly know if something doesn't sit right. Or even a whole song. Like sometimes I'll record a whole record and I'll be sitting, you know, in the basement at Jamie, the guy we recorded with, and I'll be sitting there by myself. And then when it gets to a track, every time I listen to it, the album feels weird. It's like, I don't think the track should be there, or I don't think the track should even exist.
But you got to be willing to admit that to yourself.
Exactly. It's all about like getting to that honest place, and not everything is not, I mean, I know it feels dear because you spent time on it. I mean, I think with anything creative, you're going to spend a lot of time on things that don't work. You know, I'll spend 5-6 hours on a part, and then the next morning I listen to it and it's unlistenable.
I would say with my videos, I end up editing out 20 to 30% of what I recorded, and I've never regretted it. I've never been like, oh, fuck, I wish I would have left that line in.
Yeah, and I think the more you do it, the more you realize editing, the more you edit, the better it normally is.
I always err on the side. If I'm on the fence at all about whether a particular part should be in there, I cut it.
Exactly. Yeah, the on the fence thing is very critical. I think in the past, if something bothered me, I would kind of hold it in. Even on a personal thing, let's say I'm listening back to a vocal performance, and there's one little thing, and I'm like, I'll probably get over that. That's fine.
You won't.
But I won't. Yeah. 10 years later, I'm like, I should have fixed that. I should have. So if something just creeps up in your brain to tell you maybe that's not right, do something with it.
YouTube's a little different because I'll put out a new video next week. So it doesn't have to be perfect. A record you have to live with for the rest of your life. So it's a little bit different.
It's technically your legacy. It's going to be around longer than you are, you know? So I don't know. And yeah, I think it's just healthy to be able to accept that and realize that everything you listen to, the people didn't just write it and put it out. I mean, not everything is a Bob Dylan song where he can sit down and just record something. It's, you know, it's history, you know?
There's those freaks that can just bang it out. Like I always talk about her, but you know, one of my favorite artists is Charlie XCX, and she's written like Billboard top 10 songs in like half an hour. Or written and recorded her vocals for top 10 songs in an hour and a half.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Good for her, but most of us are not like that.
Yeah, exactly. And it all depends on, I mean, we were talking earlier about what works for you and your band. I mean, for instance, with BT Bam, it's a big process to get a song done. You know, it's a very dense thing. You know, there's a lot going on. It's, you know, we spend as much or more time in pre-production and analyzing the track and fixing the track before we ever get in the studio.
I have a question about this then, and I don't normally get into the details of music on this show, but this is something that I want the audience to think about for anybody who makes music: arrangement.
Yeah.
And talk about how important that is, like that it's more than just having a cool riff.
Well, yeah, I mean, it really depends on the kind of music, honestly.
But in any kind of music, like, you're not just going to loop something for 6 minutes. Like, the song needs to have movement, things coming and going, adding little things. And I think people don't oftentimes hear that stuff consciously, but it's there, especially like with your stuff, which is, these songs are very long. How do you think about arrangement to keep a song moving for that long without adding another part necessarily?
Well, our writing's changed quite a bit. Like, in the past, it was kind of like a building block, like, we have this riff and we want to get to this riff. How do we make that? Then we take that riff and go, and it's kind of constantly evolving of just a shitload of fucking riffs, you know? And that's why our old material is so crazy, is because it never repeats. It's, you know, it's a pretty intense kind of puzzle, I guess. But now, I mean, a big part of it is because of so many people writing, and, you know, it's just about putting together, you know, all our ideas. And sometimes, as far as arranging, you know, someone will write a 5-minute song on their own, and, you know, the band will take that 5 minutes and kind of turn it into something new, because we all have kind of ideas of where we think it should go. So it's honestly tough to talk about arrangement for us, because it changes so much. Mm-hmm. And every song, it's honestly very different. I think each person needs to find out how writing works for them. And for us, it's an over analytical process. Like, we really have to analyze. And with music like ours, if everything's not in the right place, it mm-hmm. sounds like a fucking mess, you know, because so much is going on. And when you have a section with, you know, 6 different guitar tracks going on, keyboards, strings, you know, percussion, auxiliary stuff, like, plus 4 vocal parts happening, like, you need to make room for all that somehow. And so, if you're trying to do the bold, dense thing, you have to really know how to craft it in a way where it's going to be listenable,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, but at the same time, I, you know, for my solo stuff, for instance, I take a totally different approach where I will write a song off a riff. But like you said, it's not like I can just repeat a riff and that's a song. I have to create movement and somehow, you know, keep the listener interested and make, you know, either if the riff does repeat over and over and over, I have to create things around it to mm-hmm. make it kind of evolve into something else, be it vocals or, you know, percussion or drums or keys or whatever. So it's just, I don't know. I can't teach someone how to like write a song. I don't know. I just know what works for me, and I don't really know how to explain it. It just kind of happens a lot of times.
The idea of arrangement seems to be something that metal bands in particular don't really understand, probably because there isn't a lot of arrangement in a lot of the stuff that they listen to, whereas like I listen to a lot of rap and pop, and with that stuff, for example, like the Katy Perry song TGIF, like if you listen to that song, it is the same loop the entire song, but it doesn't seem like it because they did so much of what you said. There's so much happening around that loop that I listened to it. I was like, oh, this is the same like 4-bar loop the entire song. And I've heard the song dozens of times and I never noticed that. Whereas with a lot of metal bands, the default is write a new riff. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it should be intentional. Otherwise you get riff salad.
Exactly. And I think production's such a big point in that, you know, to that point is that, you know, if you listen to a session of a pop song, for instance, you'll see that loop or whatever, but you'll see how much is going on as far as production around that. So you aren't focusing on the fact that, you know, this loop is happening the entire song. You know, it's not just about the parts you're writing. It's also about the way they're recorded and the way they're mixed. And, you know, there's just so much to that. And I think, you know, a good thing pop music does is the actual stuff that's written is very bare bones and mm-hmm. simple. It's just the way it's produced that makes it very listenable to most people and keeps it interesting, you know. And so, it's tough to do that sometimes with metal. I mean, a lot of it, you know, when you're dealing with guitars that are in the forefront, you know, that distorted guitar takes over most of the, you know, the sound
entire that's spectrum, coming. Yeah.
Yeah, the whole spectrum, you know. So it's a little, I don't know, it's hard to kind of
apply
that to really aggressive music.
Getting back to the idea of giving and receiving feedback that we were talking about before, because I think this is such an important topic for people in any kind of creative field. When somebody, you know, I think you probably just don't have these people in the band anymore is my guess. But when you've dealt with somebody in the past, whether that's in the band or a tour mate or something that is really sensitive about getting feedback or approaching them, like those people that you're like, oh God, I got to talk to this guy. He's going to be butthurt about anything I say to him. How do you deal with that?
I think it's just like dealing with anyone in any aspect of your life when it comes to that. It's just sitting them down and just kind of explain your side of it. You know, just being totally honest, like this had, if you know it's going to hurt their feelings, be like, this has nothing to do with, you know, nothing you wrote was, for instance, bad or is shit or whatever. You know, there's no reason you should feel that way. I've honestly never had to do that, you know, because like you said, the past members are, the writing process wasn't as complete band involved as it is now, back then. But yeah, I mean, it's still, you don't want to hurt people's feelings ever.
What about the people who are overly sensitive? You know, there's always these bands where it's like, if you're on tour with them and they're going to get mad if you put a single piece of your shit 6 inches on their side of, you know, that kind of thing. How do you deal with that?
Well, hopefully if you're able to have a tour manager, they can deal with that properly. If you don't, hopefully you have someone in the band that can sensibly talk to other human beings in a way that's not going to cause a lot of confrontation. I mean, but just a heart to heart and kind of explaining how ridiculous it is for them to expect that, but without being like, that's fucking ridiculous, man.
Yeah.
You know, kind of look at it from our perspective, like, this is kind of weird, right? Yeah, I mean, because for instance, you know, we toured with a band, I don't want to throw anybody on the bus, but you know, they were kind of like a big hotshot metal band and they still do well. But, you know, we were playing not huge clubs, but they, you know, they were from a metal community where you didn't share gear. You mm-hmm. didn't strike your kit, you know, and we were playing, I remember in particular, we were playing on this really small ass stage and, you know, they wouldn't move any of their gear and their tour manager wouldn't let us move any of our gear because there was a local band and the mm-hmm. local band literally they wouldn't have fit on the stage. It was impossible. And it was this huge thing. We got in a fight with their tour manager, like, man, we're not fucking this band over. And, you know, his point of view was, who cares? They're a local band. But like, well, we've been that local band. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever experienced that world, but that's somewhere we come from where you do look out for everyone playing. And you do if, you know, in the old days in the hardcore scene for us, like bands would show up with no gear and they would just borrow it. You know, it was crazy. So I don't know. It's just, it's a different, you know, upbringing Sometimes that's the only time I can really think of it getting hostile. But
it's a good idea to that's actually a really good insight to give it to the tour manager or someone else if possible. That's not always the case, but you know, I think it's a good idea in general for the people, you know, I call those people the shit umbrella, because that's kind of their job, is to take the shit and shield everyone under the umbrella from it. And typically I'm the shit umbrella. And, you know, that's what our job is. Like, come to us and say, hey, here's the deal. These guys are getting really butthurt every time we do this. Can you talk to them? And we're in that job for a reason, where we'll go talk to them and go, hey, it seems like it rubbed you the wrong way when X happened. I totally understand. I would feel that way too. But here's the thing, like, it's really cramped. We'll do our very best to keep it out of your space. But, you know, I hope you understand if occasionally some things might get a little bit, you know, in your way, we apologize.
Yeah. And sometimes I think a good approach is, if the tour manager thing is not working, get some, I mean, for us, for instance, if something like that's happening and we're just like, fuck it, as a band, or as like maybe like Paul and I, because we've been around the longest or something, I don't know, we would walk up to dudes and just talk to them ourselves. Be like, listen, I know our tour managers talked to you about this, but we're coming to you as the band, as like your fellow musicians, like, let's work together. We got a long tour ahead of us. Let's make this fucking happen, you know? Because nobody wants to be on a tour for a month and a half where something is horrible every day, you know? And that, as a band headlines, you know, we have to think about that as well. You know, if we're doing something unknowingly that's affecting another band, I want them to say something to us.
You've earned the right to be an asshole.
Yeah, it's true.
Quit being a coward. Well, last thing I wanted to ask you about, because I know people want to hear about it, and we've talked about it a little bit, is kind of the scene that you guys came from, that old, like, North Carolina, like, vegan, straight-edge metalcore kind of scene, which was a really interesting moment in time. I don't know what the scene is like now, but I remember back then, there was just this weird little hot spot of those bands, and it was such a cool thing.
It was cool. I'm very fortunate to, you know, have been through it and kind of grow up and met the people I have. And I don't know, it was so small. I think that's what, you know, when I really think back about the shows or see pictures from, you know, these very important shows in my mind, you know, there was 50 people, 40 people at these shows.
Right.
You know, as a very small community.
Like, people care way more about Day of Suffering now than they did in 1999.
Yeah.
Like, exponentially.
I saw them, you know, I only saw them one time with Brother's Keeper, and it was, I mean, it's still such a mind-blowing show.
I saw them at a fest in Indiana, and there was maybe 25 people watching them at a fest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, nobody. Because nobody really cared about them. Even, I mean, in North Carolina, there was a small group that did. But yeah, outside of that, you know, that was that. And, yeah, luckily people are kind of realizing, hey, Day of Suffering started something.
Yeah, and I want to be clear, I'm not making fun of them or putting it down or anything. It's interesting to me how there's these special moments in time that, in the moment, you kind of don't understand that they're special. And then looking back, people look, you know, are like, actually, that was pretty cool. They were doing this 20 years ago.
Yeah, they were, you know, incorporating Morbid Angel and hardcore. You know, it was.
Yeah, and you guys were super, super ahead of the curve on that too. Can you talk about kind of how I always talk about this in my videos, but I don't feel like I've really gotten the point across about how just completely unheard of that was at the time to bring in that kind of real death metal and progressive kind of stuff into hardcore.
It really was. I mean, I remember, because I was in a band called From Here On that was, you know, kind of a, you know, I loved Turmoil, and you know, that was kind of like, we were kind of that world. I remember playing with Nile, and it was horrible for us. You know, it was constant heckling. I mean, those two worlds just didn't coexist. I remember seeing Life of Agony with Carcass, and Life of Agony got heckled the entire show. You know, the singer was, horrible things were yelled at him. And
yeah, I can guess what they were.
Yeah, exactly. And so from a very, and that I was probably 16, you know, so from a very early age, I kind of saw this, and it was very weird to me because I grew up a metalhead. You know, I that was what I grew up on, was like strictly metal. And then I found hardcore, and that was what I connected to in high school. And, you know, I just fell in love with the community involved around it, because there was no metal community for me from where I live. And if there was, it wasn't anything I wanted to be part of. So I don't know. And I think most of us kind of had that same experience where we grew up listening to things like Morbid Angel and Cannibal Corpse, but we also loved Sick of It All. And we loved fucking Earth Crisis and, you know, and all this stuff. And so I think it was just the love of all these kind of music that is very similar, but was, as a society, looked at way, you know, something that didn't belong at all. And we kind of didn't agree with that, I guess. And, you know, Prayer for Cleansing, for instance, you know, I wasn't in the band when they wrote their, you know, their full length, but I was friends with them, and we all were obsessed with Cradle of Filth, you know, and you, when you listen to that record, you can hear that influence.
And zero people in hardcore were listening to Cradle of Filth then.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it wasn't just something that was heard of at all back then. And like you said, with the prog stuff, I remember even BT Bam, when I started playing keyboards, that was,
you can't do that.
And people made fun of me all the time. Like, I mean, notoriously in Europe, one time I was setting up and this guy just goes, "Keyboards are gay."
Sounds about right.
Yeah. Like, I mean, we just always got shit for stuff. And then it slowly like became completely normal. And, you know, I remember when, I mean, VOD, for instance, people were weirded out that he sung. Like, mm-hmm. When bands started singing in hardcore, it was such a weird thing. And then luckily there was that kind of evolution of the emo side of thing kind of crept into hardcore. And it was kind of cool to see a lot of that evolve, you know, on all different sides of it. And, you know, luckily we were kind of in the metal side of it, because that's just what we all grew up on and loved, you know.
Well, the lesson to me, the takeaway for anybody listening to this is, like, if there's something cool going on, support it now. Like, don't wait until 10 or 15 years later, after they all broke up and had to get jobs and stuff. Like,
I know, it's so weird. Like, the guy that does merch for us, he's, I think, 23, and he's, you know, very in touch with what's going on with, you know, the hardcore scene right now. And it is mind-blowing, like you said, how much of those bands are still talked about and people love them.
I hear people bring up Disembodied all the time in my comments. And Disembodied are great, but like, I saw them with like Overcast and maybe Candiria or something, which is an amazing lineup that people would like shit themselves over now. 40 people there in Cleveland.
Yeah, those bands were making $2,000 a year as a band.
Totally.
like it's crazy.
I remember one of them, we booked one of their shows in Cleveland, and one of those bands wanted $300 for a guarantee. And we were like, what the fuck? Like, who do you think you are?
Yeah. That's so crazy to think about. Yeah. And I mean, and people are like, where are all these bands reuniting? It's like, they've never made a dollar.
Or played to more than like 8 people.
Yeah. Let them experience it. Fuck. Like, don't criticize the fact that they're coming back, especially if they can pull it off, you know? So, I mean, that's obviously why a lot of these bands are coming back. They realize that people are connecting with those songs, and, you know, it's awesome. A lot of that stuff still holds up. So
absolutely. Cool. Well, I will let you go. I'm sure you got a lot of other stuff to do today, but thank you so much for joining. Any last words or anything you want to plug or mention before I let you go?
Yeah, we're trying, as all bands, we're trying to figure, we were supposed to do a 20-year tour this year, doing our album, The Great Misdirect in Full, playing full set, only band. I mean, 2 full sets. And we were really looking forward to it. We're trying to figure out if it's going to happen in 2021. So yeah, we're just trying to stay busy. I have a new solo EP that came out a couple of weeks ago, so check that out. And yeah, we're always working on stuff. So just keep checking, and thanks for caring.
Keep checking.
Yeah.
All right, my friends, that does it for this episode of the podcast. If you made it this far, thank you. Thank you for listening. We sincerely appreciate each and every one of you. If you want to help the show, there's a couple things that you can do. First of all, share it on social media. If you share it, tag us, tag Finn McKenty, that's me, and tag Deanna Chapman, that's a producer. Second thing you can do, if you really, really, really love us and really want to support us, you can support us on Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to this, or you can do none of that. And you can just sit at home, think about how awesome this podcast is. That works too. Again, thank you very much to each and every one of you for listening. We sincerely appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Blake Weiland. I'm the host of the Tone Mob Podcast. It's a show where I interview guitar people about guitar stuff. We talk about their pedals, their amps, their accessories, their preferences, all that stuff, as well as a healthy dose of whatever comes up. Topics have ranged from aliens to addiction and anywhere in between. Oh yeah, and pizza. We're definitely going to be talking about pizza. So get the show wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Just search The Tone Mob in your search bar and it will pop right up. Come join us. We're having a lot of fun. Thanks for checking it out.